This is Patricia Morgan interviewing for the Dialect and Heritage Project for Leeds University on Wednesday the 14th of June 2023. Can I ask you to introduce yourself?
Yes, my name's John Stinton. I currently reside at Ellerslie Walsh in the Teme Valley in the county of Worcestershire.
Also present is Pete Blackmore, also from the Dialect and Heritage Project, providing whatever support is required.
When were you born, John?
I was born on the 7th of March, 1947.
And where were you born?
I was born in Worcester Royal Infirmary.
Wow. So that's changed a little over time. Have you been back there at all?
The first time I spent any time in hospital was last November, November 22. I had a tumour removed on part of the thyroid gland in the neck, which was very successful. But apart from that, I'd never been in hospital from birth in my lifetime.
So you've had a very healthy life?
Well, I've always been very physical. Everything I've done in life has mostly been physical work.
Whereabouts did you grow up?
I was brought up in Ellerslie Walsh by my grandparents until I was 11 years of age. Then, unfortunately, my grandfather died. She left me alone there with my grandmother. So at that point, I became man of the house.
Mm-hmm. What would you do? What was your grandfather's work?
He was an agricultural worker. He and my grandmother had worked a farm on the side of the Teme Valley above Martley, called Upper Southwood. And one of my uncles was killed there when he was 18 in an accident. And so they gave it up in 1939, and he moved down into the Teme Valley at Ellerslie Walsh and became just a labourer for Kirby Brothers Courthouse Farm, Ellerslie. Obviously the war broke out. My mother, her name was Hilda Louise Stinton. She joined the army in the nursing corps. So the story goes, in 1945, my father was involved in part of the Rhine Crossing, Montgomery's Rhine Crossing. And he got badly injured, and she nursed him. That's how they met. Then she came home after the war. He went back to Bath, which is where he lived. And then he was sent to somewhere in the Far East and got killed out there. So she later on married a Welsh shepherd called Fred. By which she had a brother and sister to me, half-brother and half-sister. But they moved away from Ellerslie. He came there to be Kirby's shepherd. But they then moved away because he had a big dispute with Mr. Kirby. I was left with my grandmother and father. And so, as I say...
Where was your mum in all of this?
She moved off with him, her husband. They moved up into Wales. But then they moved around the country to various farms. So I started work in spare time work when I wasn't at school. When I was 11, I began working on the farm. Nights, weekends, holidays. Because we needed the money, we hadn't got any money. So it was a very hard life, but it made me physically strong. I learned a lot of things.
Yeah.
And progressed through life, so there you go.
What sort of relationship did you have with your grandma?
I had a very good relationship with her. She was very good to me.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons I went on the farm, because I didn't really want to be a farm worker, but by the time I left school at the age of 15, that was in 1962,
yeah,
she wasn't at all a well woman. She'd got trouble with her legs, mainly arthritic problems. And I didn't want to be too far away from home. I wanted to be where I could get back home, maybe lunch times and things like that, in case she'd had a problem or a fall.
Yeah.
And so the obvious place to get a job was on the farm, which was, well, we lived adjacent to it. So I started work on the same farm that my grandfather had worked on. And so I was there then for about 20 years.
What sort of farm was it? Was
mixed farm, cattle,
yeah,
sheep, pigs, caged battery hens, hops, corn,
yeah,
sugar beet,
yeah,
and then of course the Kirby brothers. There were three brothers. This particular farm was run by Douglas Kirby.
Yeah.
His brother Robert farmed another farm. It was a consortium, but he farmed another farm at the other side of the river, on the other side of the valley, called the Pardhouse Farm.
Yeah.
And then the other brother farmed another one, which was a fruit farm, totally fruit, hardwood fruit, not soft fruits,
yeah,
on the way up to Clifton-on-Tyme from going up out of the Tyme Valley at Tambridge,
yeah,
on the left, which was called the Noak Farm. So there was actually three farms in a consortium. And so we, as the working force, got moved around the farms whenever necessary, you know, according to the seasons, because in the winter there was work to do in the hop yards, maintaining the wire work and the poles, yeah, and everything. And then in the deep winter, there was pruning work to do on the trees at the Noak and fencing work to do on the other farms against the livestock and stuff. So, yeah, we were always flat out. We were never short of work.
What's the different skills you picked up, though? Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I did enjoy it. I enjoyed the art. I learned how to fence. Not sword fencing, obviously. I learnt a certain amount about livestock.
Yeah.
Animal husbandry, sheep farming.
Yeah.
I learned a lot about driving. You'd be surprised how much skill there is involved in driving agricultural tractors.
Oh, yeah.
And if you can drive agricultural tractors competently, there's not much you can't drive. I got an HGV in 1973 from being on the farm, because I used to drive the stock lorry.
Yeah.
So I didn't have to take a test to get an HGV, and I've just given it up this year, age 76. Mm. And I've given it up because the GPs at Knightwick Surgery, who I'm affiliated to, wanted £100 to give me a medical.
Goodness me.
And I said, well, you know, I'd rather give the licence up. So I've just given that up.
Yeah. Doesn't affect your driving otherwise, though?
No, I mean, I can drive my car and everything, but up until May of this year, I could drive any heavy lorry on British roads.
Yeah.
I could still
take stock to market?
Oh, yeah. I used to have to move stock to and fro.
I was going to say, how far do you go with stock?
Oh, wherever he Douglas Kirby would buy young sheep from Penrith up in Cumbria, and I'd go up and fetch loads of young sheep down from there, breeding sheep.
Yeah.
We'd go to different slaughterhouses all over the West Midlands. I used to run into livestock into Banbury stockyards,
yeah,
which at the time was the biggest livestock market in Europe. This was prior to, obviously, well prior to the mad cow disease outbreak. That finished Banbury off. But before that, Banbury was a massive livestock market, so we ran into there. Used to do Worcester, Hereford. Used to buy a lot of cattle in Hereford Market. So we'd be hauling cattle back sometimes all day from there if he had a big buy. Because most of the time they'd got 300 plus cattle on the farms, on the two farms, Pardhouse and Courthouse, being fattened for butchering, for killing.
Did you milk at all?
No,
the farm?
No, there was no dairy. There had been prior to me beginning work there, back in the 40s and 50s, they did have dairy. But they got out of dairy when I started with them. It was purely beef. But he used to buy what was known, or still is known in the farming circles, as store cattle. So basically what happens is most dairy farmers obviously need the cows for milk. So to get the cows into milk, they have to calve the cows. So they usually put the dairy cow to a good stock beef bull. Some of the French breeds now are very popular, but it used to be, in those days, nearly always Herefords. So they put Hereford bull to a Friesian or whatever. And then you'd get these brown and white and black and white cattle coming through. So the cows were taken off the cow to put her on the milk circuit to be milked. And the calves were usually taken into market, and very small farmers, what they call breeder farmers, would buy these calves and they would raise them up on milk and cereals, and then as soon as they could eat hay, they'd get them on the way. They'd bring them up to maybe 6-8 months old when they were kind of starting to mature, and that's when the beef cattle buyers, store cattle buyers, would buy them off them at the market. So they were then referred to as buying store cattle. Then they would feed them up on grass and whatever till they were big enough to go to the slaughterhouse for butchering. So that's how it was done.
Because it's very fertile soil around here, isn't it?
The Teme Valley is very fertile because all the best soil from up on the sides over the thousands of years have obviously washed down onto the valley floor. So there's a lot of good land down on the Teme Valley floor, as there is in most valleys in the country.
Had sheep as well on the farm.
Pardon?
Had sheep as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We had, between the two farms, we had 750 breeding ewes.
So were you involved very much with the lambing? It's a busy time of year.
My wife and I used to lamb all of them.
Did you?
For about 6 years we did that.
Yeah. When did you meet your wife?
She came to pick ops. She was from the Black Country.
Ah, whereabouts? Do you remember?
Yes, she was off a big house in the state at Dudley called the Wren's Nest Estate.
Yes, I know the Wren's Nest.
Yeah, well, that's where she came from.
Wow, what a contrast for her then.
Pardon?
What a contrast.
Yes, she didn't know anything about country life. Only what she'd picked up when she'd been out working in the hops, because she had been hopping all her, when she was a child. And she came with her grandmother. Her grandmother brought a crew of hoppers down.
Yeah. How old was she when you met her?
17.
And how old was she when you married?
She was 18 when I married her. Coming up to 19. Yeah, she was 19 in the June. She was 18. Yeah. We married on the 1st of April. And she was 19 on the June.
Yeah, and how old were you?
I was 20.
That's what we did. We got married much earlier, didn't we, then?
I think everybody did. Yeah. I think everybody got married earlier in those days.
Yeah, and she adapted well to
she started out working on the farm, because in those days, having hops and fruit, there was work for the women all through the year as well as the men.
Yeah.
There was very, very few months when the women couldn't work. I mean, around Christmas, they were busy with turkeys and poultry. You know, there was a lot of farms kept turkeys. There was a farm the other side of the river. They kept hundreds of bloody turkeys and chickens. And then Stiles is at Stanford. They had massive poultry breeding places there. They used to keep anything up to 20,000 hens and 5,000 or 6,000 turkeys.
Did you get involved in that particularly or not?
I used to go at night and help to load when they took live loads.
Yeah.
They had to be caught and put into crates to go onto the lorries to be taken live. I didn't get involved in the actual dressing of poultry to go straight to the markets for table.
No.
But we used to go and do that at night because it was what we called in those days. I mean, I'm talking about in the 60s. And they used to pay, if you went, you used to have to go at, what would it be, 10 o'clock at night and work till 4 or 5 in the morning.
Yeah.
Catching the, well, there was a guy who used to catch his chickens, but you used to take them off him in fours, two in each hand, carry them out and put them in the crates.
Yeah.
And
they're more docile at night.
Well, they are, and they had to be on the road to get them back to where they'd got to go, look, before, so they could be processed through the following day.
So was this a second job or a bit of
Well, it was. You could describe it as moonlighting because they paid us cash.
Right.
But we were being paid £1 an hour, which was fantastic money then.
Yeah,
I mean, I worked 45 hours a week in 1966 for £6 a week. That was my take-home pay. When I started, when I was 15 in 62, I had £3.13.09 to take home for 45 hours.
Yeah.
Well, you couldn't buy a pint of beer for that now.
No. But you could buy lots of pints of beer for it.
Did you have rent to pay? Or?
No, we lived in tight accommodation. The house belonged to the farm.
Yeah.
So you didn't pay any rent.
What about overheads, things like electricity, gas?
Well, when I was a kid, we didn't have any of that.
No. So how did you cook?
Solid fuel cooker, firewood, Rayburn.
Yeah.
Some people had Argus, but Rayburn was more popular because it would burn anything.
Yeah.
Argus just burned coke or anthracite.
Yeah.
You couldn't get firewood into them. Of course, living out there, there's an abundance of firewood. And so everybody wanted Rayburns or Rayburn-type cookers.
Yeah.
And then we had oil lamps and candles.
Yeah.
And old paraffin tillies, you know, with a mantle.
Yeah.
We didn't get electricity up the Teme Valley till 1958.
And what about a water supply?
Pump or a well.
Yeah. So?
No mains. We didn't get mains till 1960. We had mains water, I think, somewhere around there. Before that, you carried it in a bucket.
And that was the same with wastewater as well, I suppose.
Wasn't any waste. Well, wastewater, like washing up water, and that they used to sling it out on the garden. We had got these old brown clay porcelain sinks in the. Some people had got them in the house, which had got a waste pipe outside, but it just went on the floor.
But did you get sewage services once the mains water was?
Not unless you put your own septic tank in.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
No sewage pipes around. Well, our sewage facilities was a wooden board with a hole in and a bucket underneath it. No, that's true. And even the council houses, which there's a load of council houses built around here. They built them in 1935. Before the war, 1935, in the 30s period. And when they built them, they were built with pig's cots.
Yeah.
And brick toilets outside, back to back.
Yeah.
Because the houses were semi-detached. And they were bucket lavatories.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, this house would have been the same.
Yeah.
And we lived like that up into the 60s. And, people talk now about living in poverty, and they don't know what living in poverty is. They got no idea what living in poverty is. No idea.
So where did you go to
school? It's all relative, isn't it?
Shelsley Beecham C of E, the other side of the river, directly opposite to where I am. And there was no electric there when I started school, and the toilet system was the same there.
Was it?
And there was no... There was a washroom on the side of the school with a bench right round the interior with enamel bowls all set out. And then they gave two of the senior boys, their job every day was to fetch water from the pump and fill the bowls up.
Yeah.
And then you washed your hands in these bowls of water and used the same water all day. About 20 bowls for about 60 kids.
Yeah.
You had carbolic soap. It was carbolic, so that it killed all the bugs.
Well, it smelled good as well.
It smelled better than the water. And soggy wet towels and then we had...
Did you feel deprived as a child, or was it you just accepted that this is what it was?
We didn't know anything else.
No.
I mean, they talk about these third world countries and how people live under these conditions. Well, we lived under the same conditions. There was millions of people lived in this country, even up to 1963, 64, under those conditions.
Yeah.
Well, it can't get much more basic than a hole in a plank and a bucket.
Well, I have to smile sometimes because they put these, what they class as historical programs on the television, where they try to depict how people lived in Saxon times or early Norman times, and they talk about having to go to the pumps or go to the well with these wooden pails and fetch water and all this, and what a dreadful life they had. And I thought, we still had the same blasted life when I was a kid.
Tell me about when you did the washing, the weekly wash. Did you have a wash house to do that?
We had a
copper boiler.
You had a cast iron boiler.
Yeah.
In a brick casement with a chimney up the side of the house.
Yeah.
And you had a fire underneath it.
Yeah.
And then usually behind the boiler, because they usually built them in a corner of this little room.
Yeah.
You had, you usually had a shelf around the behind the boiler, and on there they kept the sunlight soap.
Yeah.
They didn't use washing powder. They had chunks of this big bars of this yellow soap made at Port Sunlight up in Cheshire.
Yeah.
Sunlight soap. And they used to get the boiler red hot, get the water boiling, and then they used to drop these couple of bars of this soap in and let it melt. And then in went all the washing, and they had this stick they used to churn it up with. Called a dolly stick.
Dolly stick, yeah.
And they used to pick it up out of the water and slap it back in. There was shards of boiling water flying about the place. Nobody took any notice. You know, if you got a bit...
A ringer and a
Yeah, well, they had the mangle outside. They called it the mangle.
The mangle.
And you had a screw on the top that you could tighten the springs down to make the rollers press it tighter.
Yeah.
And if you didn't disappear out of sight, you got commandeered to turn the handle.
Yeah.
So everybody dashed off when they knew the mangle.
Did you have a tin bath underneath?
Yeah, catch the water, put it back in the boiler.
Yeah.
And then...
Did your grandma use a washboard as well as the dolly?
No.
No.
She always used this boiler system.
Yeah.
And we lived on the corner at New Mill Bridge in Shelsley Walsh. On the corner of the road, adjacent to the bridge over the Tyne, and then about 300 metres down the field was another house called the Forge, which had been an old iron foundry back in the 1700s. Well, my aunt and uncle lived there, and their family. So my grandmother and Aunt Marjorie, they used to share wash days. She'd come up to New Mill Bridge on Mondays and help my grandmother to boil everything up there. It all had to be done on the same day. It was washing day. They called it washing day.
Monday.
That's right,
Monday, washing day.
Well, it was for us. And then Aunt Marge had her wash day on a Wednesday.
Yeah.
So then my grandmother go down there in Alper. So I had a cousin, mention no names, but he was very spoilt, this lad. My Uncle Eric, Aunt Marge's husband, Uncle Eric, thought the sun shone out of him, and she wasn't allowed to scold him or smack his backside or anything like that. Although he'd tell his father, and then Uncle Eric would take it out on Aunt Marjorie. So he used to do as he pleased. And if he wanted something and he was refused, he'd hold his breath. And he'd hold his breath till he literally would turn blue.
Yeah.
And he used to frighten Aunt Marjorie to death with this technique.
Yeah.
And so he arrives with Aunt Marjorie this one Monday, and he wants the soap, the sunlight soap.
Yeah.
And my grandmother said, no, you're not having it. He said, hold my breath. She said, you do what you like. You're not having the soap. So Aunt Marjorie said, oh, give it him, Mother. She said, for God's sake. She said, oh, he'll hold his breath till he faints. She said, you'll be all right, Marjorie. Don't you worry about him.
That's right.
Anyway, he said, I'm going to hold my breath. And sure enough, he did. And Aunt Marjorie's panicking. And my grand, give him the soap, Mother, give him the soap, for God's sake. And the old lady, she's got this bucket here, half full of water, and she's got another over here. She said, be all right in a minute, Marjorie, don't you worry about him. So she fires this half a bucket into the other and fills it up. And all of a sudden, she grabs him by the scruff of the neck and the arse of his trousers, and she tips him head first straight in. straight in the bucket, and held him in there. Well, when she loosed him out, he didn't hold his breath anymore. Put a stop to that.
But what did he want the soap for?
Just wanted it.
Well,
fascinated by the fact that it was yellow and it was, I don't know what he thought, but he wasn't
volunteering to do the washing.
Not at all. He just wanted to play with the soap. She wasn't having it. Anyway, she told him, if you hold your breath and your mother comes and tells me, I'll put you back in the water. And, yeah, he didn't do it again. That cured the problem for the rest of his life. He never did it again.
Did you go on to have your own family, your own children?
Yeah, yeah. But they knew all about curing syndromes in them days. You see, you've got a syndrome. If you, in this modern day and age, they'd say you've got some syndrome. But they knew how to cure syndromes.
Well, I think it's a technique children use sometimes.
My grandmother had a good cure for syndromes. It was called a wooden coat hanger. And it was a special instrument for curing syndromes.
Did you get it very often?
Well, any syndromes we had, she soon cured them. She put a stop to it.
Tell me about your children.
I had, our first one was Kevin.
Yeah.
We had him in 16, and we married in 67.
Yeah.
On the 1st of April, and Kevin was born 7th of September, 69.
Yeah.
And then we had Caroline in 73. And then we fostered a daughter. She got a bad life in a bad place. And we took her on in, when did we have Tracy? 73. 82 we had Tracy.
Yeah. And How old was she when you fostered?
She was 11 when we had her.
Oh my goodness.
She's 55 now.
Yeah.
She's got her own kid, but she's very good.
Good.
And
that's a difficult age, isn't it, to foster a child?
Yeah, well, we knew her. I'd known her since she was four. She came with some people, Hoppikin.
Yeah.
And they abandoned her when she was 11, left her with her mother's sister, who was very cruel to her.
Right.
So, and she wanted to come back to Shelsea because she'd lived there for quite a while. So we fostered her.
Yeah.
And then we had our youngest, Hannah, in 87.
Yeah.
There was 15 years between her and Caroline.
Yeah.
And we lost Caroline in 2005. She died of lung cancer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So that was a painful business.
Yeah.
She became a nursing sister, and she worked at at Manchester at the Christie,
yeah,
which is a cancer teaching hospital.
Yeah.
And she got lung cancer herself when she was 29. And she didn't smoke. And nobody could explain to me why she caught it. They got no idea.
No.
But it killed her very quickly. And at the period of time that she was being treated, they treated her at Withenshaw.
Yeah.
And then Hannah, who was 17 then, she had lymph cancer. Anyway, Hannah recovered. She's a practice nurse in Worcester now.
Oh, right. So this nursing carries on through there.
Yeah, well, my mother was an army nurse. I told you earlier on, she was an army nurse. My grandmother was a midwife.
Was she?
Yeah.
Whereabouts had she been a midwife?
Oh, in the local area. They used to call her if they needed her.
Yeah.
It was one of the call a midwife jobbies. If she was wanted, they'd come. They'd walk miles to fetch her.
Yeah. Was she qualified as a midwife, or was it?
She was qualified by the fact that her mother had been one, and she taught her.
Yeah.
They kind of, I suppose.
She didn't do a formal training or anything.
No, they didn't, did they? Then.
No.
I mean, back then it was. They had to pick it up as they went along.
Yeah.
But the same thing happens with animal husbandry. Most of these farmers and shepherds, they never had any education in the job. They learned it as they went along.
Yeah.
You know, obstetrics, you have to learn it as you go. And the things, some of the things they knew were amazing, really, that they understood about these things, although they were ignorant of what it was. It's like certain diseases that lambs get when they're born. Well, we know now that a lot of it is E. coli and stuff like that. Well, they didn't know what it was, but they knew how to deal with it.
Yeah.
They learnt over the years how to deal with it. And, they were... Some of the techniques they used, especially with sheep having difficult births, were quite amazing what they knew and how they could get over these kind of things and what they could do. And... If you've not done it and you haven't been amongst these people, because it's a concept that a lot of people that live out on farms and do that kind of work are kind of ignorant. They think, a lot of people think they're ignorant, and they're not ignorant by any means. They're very, very clever people, but in their own sphere.
Have you been treated as ignorant in your lifetime?
Have I?
Have you been treated as ignorant in your lifetime?
Oh, anybody who talks rustic with a rustic accent is usually acknowledged as being ignorant or semi-ignorant. So you know, you kind of get used to.
Who mostly do you find?
Oh, people from the city.
Yeah.
Because
people who don't understand what's going on.
Well, I always.
Do you think it's tribal in a way?
I don't know. I think it's been a butt of comedy for many years, the village idiot and all this sort of nonsense. And I mean, if you went back into the 1800s, they did exist, but they also existed in the cities and towns because people intermarried.
If you know about the Black Country, and you will do that from your wife, you'll know that actually there's an essence there where people who don't earn very much money sometimes get ridiculed, and yet they have amazing skills.
Yeah, I know.
So it's called respect, I think.
Yes, it is, but I think there were. I mean, they used to regard these people as simpletons or village idiots, which they did exist, and they existed because people interbred. And they interbred because nobody had got transport.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you worked as a scullery maid all day, or you worked as a ploughman on a farm walking behind horses, and you got back home at night and you were looking for a prospective husband or wife, you weren't going to walk 20 mile after you'd done a hard day, and you hadn't got any other form of transport. So people married within a mile or a couple of mile of each other.
Yeah.
And this went on for centuries.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose with the hot fields around here and bringing and people coming in from some distance away, that was
a big help, I think.
Difference.
And of course, the other thing was a guy came along and invented. Well, he didn't invent it, but he made it possible for people to buy it, who hadn't got a lot of money, and that was Mr. Raleigh.
Yes.
Because he brought along the old push bike, and once people could travel 10 or 12 miles, mm-hmm. instead of walking a mile, they could push bike down the road 10 miles, people started to marry from further afield.
You had advantages in so much that you could drive HGV, you could travel.
Yeah, well, travelling is what changed it all, wasn't it?
Yeah. And did you find that helpful, or did you find resentment when you travelled?
From day one, I always wanted to be able to move around.
Yeah.
And so I, my uncle, who lived in Warwick, bought me an old Ford Prefect for £5 when I was 16.
Yeah.
And I started driving it round Charlesley and I hadn't got a licence. And then the local policeman who lived here in Clifton Village, he stopped me one day and he said, you're going to have to stop doing this, John. He said, or I'm going to have to nick you. And I said, well, I'm not doing any harm. He said, no, but he said, you've got no licence. So I went and got a provisional licence for a motorcycle. 10 shilling, I think I paid for it, something like that. Because you couldn't get a car licence till you were 17.
That's right.
And I put a L plate on the damn thing and started driving it around again. And, of course, he stopped me again. And he said, if I catch you again, he said, I'll arrest you. And I said, well, I've got a licence now. He said, yes, but this has got four wheels. He said, and your licence has only got two. So I had to leave it till I was 17, and then I got a proper provisional. And my cousin Roger, he was a year older than me, Rog. He was a great fan of Roger, was a wonderful guy. And he passed his test, and he trucked around with me and got me proficient, and I took a test in Worcester and passed.
Good.
But it was easy then, you know, as long as you could drive and stick your arm out the window. That's all they wanted, wasn't it? It was. You must remember when you started driving, it was the same thing. It wasn't like it is now. I mean, you know, but then again, there wasn't the traffic and the cars didn't do the speed.
Things have changed somewhat, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you need
to. But if you think of the skills that you picked up along the way, I guess driving HGV now is more of a challenge than it would have been.
Yeah, I left the farm and went into a quarry to work because of the money. Farm pay was of no consequence whatsoever. You couldn't save money working on a farm. So they wanted workmen in a quarry at Martley, down, which is about 3 or 4 miles down the road from here.
Hmm.
It was called Penny Hill Quarry. And I went there, and they paid us piecework for doing what they called drilling and blasting.
Right.
And what happened was the main man, He was known as the shot firer. He used to drill the face and blow the face off.
Yeah.
40 or 50,000 ton he'd bring down with big pieces of explosive. And then they'd load these with these old face shovels. Look, Dieslop, rusting face shovel, into dumpers. And then that would be put through the crushing unit and go out through production in different sizes. Well, some of these stones were too big to go in the crusher. They wouldn't go down the neck.
Yeah.
So they had to be reduced. So, I mean, you've got stones bigger than this table and sometimes as big as this room. Well, they had to be blown up again. So our job was to drill a hole in it and put a charge in it and link it up to the next one. And they paid us, I can't remember what it was now, but I used to earn, and the guy who worked with me, we'd earn £60 a week each on this job. And one of the reasons it was well paid was because it's very dangerous.
Mm. When was that?
I started in there because we needed the money to get married, so that would have been in 66.
Yeah.
I worked there from 66 to 69.
Yeah.
That was blooming good money for those.
Oh, massive money. Yeah, but there weren't many people would do it because it was so dangerous.
So what was the stone? Was it used for road stone or concrete?
And house footings and pathways and all sorts. I mean, they produced quite a lot of stone every week and it was always taken. There was lorries coming in all the time for it. But we'd try and charge 200 a day if we could, and then link them all up and blow the lot on a night time. And we'd...
At night time?
When I say night time, I mean 4:30, 5 o'clock.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, in the winter it was night time.
Yeah, yeah.
You charge one day and drill the next day. You used to swap because nitroglycerin gives off a lot of vapour and it gives you a headache.
Yeah.
So you swap jobs every other day so that you could get a rest from it. Mm. And then you had to drill into the middle of this rock with a rotary rock hammer air compressor, which would drive them in. And then you had these sticks of gelignite, and you had a aluminium knife. You couldn't use anything metallic because of a spark. And you'd have this stick of gelignite, and you had to determine how big a piece to put in the rock by the size of the rock.
Yeah.
And like some of these rocks, be like the size of this table, they'd be maybe 3 centimetres across this stick of jelly. And you'd saw a piece off, like cutting a piece off a sausage. And then you had a slow-burning fuse with a detonator on this end and an ignition detonator on the other end. Now, they all had to be made. And the fuse came in rolls, like rolls of cord. And you had to cut every fuse exactly the same length, so the burn time was the same. I think we used to cut them a yard long. But if you cut them shorter or longer, look, they wouldn't go off at the same time.
Yeah.
So then you crimped the detonator on the end with a crimping plier, and you crimped the other one on the other end, which was the ignition det, and he'd got like a slot in the side of him. So then you push a copper skewer into the jelly, you push the detonator into the jelly knight, and you drop it down, feed it down the hole on the end of the fuse. Then you pour sand in and you get this wooden stick and you ram it, what they call stemming. You have to bang it in with a stick. And it's a bit nerve-wracking when you first start.
Were there any accidents at all?
Well, that was the thing, you see. Sometimes the worst problem was when you fired them, if it was a wet day, if a couple didn't go off. Because when the shovel driver started to load him up and he found one that hadn't gone off, he'd roll him back into the pile you were going to charge the next day.
Yeah.
And he'd say, there's one there that's alive.
Right.
Well, if by some chance you or your partner didn't know that, the danger was you'd drill into the damn thing, into the live charge, then you'd be in trouble because he'd blow up underneath you.
Yeah.
And one or two blokes got killed doing that. Not at Martley, but around the country.
Yeah.
Look at the drill bits.
Drill bit hit the detonator and away it went, see. Because
you need to know what you're doing, don't you?
Well, it was a dangerous job. And that's why it paid so well. And
was it a relief to give the job up? You said you did it for 3 years.
I gave it up when I got married.
Yeah.
Well, I gave it up after I got married, but, I mean, when Kevin was coming along, when she was pregnant with Kevin, I gave it up because I thought, if I get bloody killed at it, she'll be on her own with him.
Yeah.
So I went back on the farm for a short while.
Yeah.
And anyway, I did that for a while, and I worked with several other guys that worked on it. One of them lived up here in the village. He still does, actually. His name's, do you know Sid Haywood?
Yes.
So Sidney was working with me on it, and Sidney, you cut this jelly look to suit the rock, because the idea was that when you blew this rock, you didn't blow him to smithereens. You just blew him enough to shatter him.
Yeah.
That was the way you did it. Well, Sid used to like to see him go properly, so he was dropping a full size pill down the hole. Then he was putting the piece in on the end of the fuse. And he fired him. We fired him, and there was nothing on, just a blue patch on the floor where this stone, and some of it landed out on the hillside road. Anyway,
he got away with it, though.
He did it several times. And the foreman up there was a guy called John Murphy from Martley.
Yeah.
Well, John knew there was something wrong. Well, they had a specialist come out from Polar Ammon, the manufacturer. That's a subsidiary of ICI.
Yeah.
They made the stuff. And he tested all this jelly in the magazine, and he said there's nothing wrong with the jelly night. So one day, John came up with a long hazelnut stick with a point on, and he pulled one of Sid's charges out, and then he pushed the stick down the hole, and of course he brought the other one out on the end of the stick. Like a sausage on a stick. And so Sid had the sack. That was the end of Sid. They gave him the sack.
What did he go on to do then?
He went on to road construction and stuff, and he ended up in Shropshire, up here, make road, when they did all those roads up around Telford.
Yeah.
He worked up there. Funnily enough, one of my half-brother, he worked on the same job, and he and Sid became friends.
Yeah.
Which was strange.
And so Sid's still back here.
Yeah, he lives in the village here now.
Yeah.
But, this damn stuff was highly, it is highly explosive. And we used to charge maybe 200, get them ready, and then the ignition detonator on the top, we used to have this stuff called Cortex.
Right.
And it looked like a piece of nylon washing line. And it was actually explosive fuse. And we used to have to, it was on a roll, you used to have to take it from one detonator to the next, like a spider's web all over these stones, and join them all together, and then bring it back to the shelter, where we used to have to get, and then used to connect the end of that to an electric detonator, and you had the mag box, you know, the big stick you push down.
Yeah.
So then they'd start the siren off to say it was going to go, and you had to wait 2 minutes with the siren going, and then you push the bloody box down, and it was like a flash of lightning over these stones. They reckon this stuff burns at, the burn rate is 300 miles a second.
And when I was in the TA,
yeah,
that's what we used to call det cord.
That's it, yeah, Cortex.
Yeah.
It's made from cordite.
Yeah,
cord.
Nobody's really, almost
so did you have ear defenders?
Pardon?
Did you have ear defenders?
Never heard of ear defenders.
Fingers in your
They hadn't thought of anything like that then. Nor when these chainsaws come out.
People's hearing.
Pardon?
Did you quite.
Yeah, exactly. No, I'm 76. And you do talk rather quietly. Pardon?
Have you noticed one of the things to ask you, what does dialect mean to you? Is there a different way of speaking here in the Teme Valley, do you think, to talking in Worcester?
I would say Teme Valley, Martley and Clifton, the dialect up here is all the same, Upper Sapie, all around there. I don't think the dialect changes much till you get the other side of Tenbury.
Yeah.
Or you get the other side of Stourport. Once you get the other side of Stourport, you start to go a bit kind of black countryfied.
Yeah. Brummy.
Brummified, yeah. But down here it's...
Two different things.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I know it is.
I know
that they are. I know my lady, if somebody told her she was a Brummie, she'd go berserk.
Yeah, that's why I asked the question.
Yeah. No, you can, I can absolutely tell the difference between Wolverhampton, Dudley and Birmingham accents. Yeah, I can tell the difference.
And can you tell the difference with Team Valley? Do you know people that have come from this area?
I can now, because 90% of them didn't start out here.
Hmm.
They moved into the area. Mm-hmm. Most of the people I knew are in the boneyard. I know more people in the graveyard at Chelsea than I do in the village. A lot moved away. Because what destroyed rural life more than anything was mechanisation, you see. Because...
Did it free you up a bit? Did you have hobbies? Did you have...
No, they just give you the sack. You had to get a job somewhere else.
So what did you do after the quarry?
Went back on the farm for a while. And then I went on truck driving.
Yeah.
And then I started working with a guy at Martley called Jack Holliday. And he was a builder in agricultural buildings. He did... farm buildings, milk stores, grain stores, anything like that. Houses he could build, lay concrete. He was a good all-round construction man. And I went and worked with him weekends and nights. And I went self-employed after I'd had 3 years on the road, on the lorries.
Yeah.
And I worked with Jack. And I learned another trade with him, which was construction. And I also worked as a contractor on the estate here, on Brockhill Estate, with the Ed Forrester in the timber. So I went on timber falling and tree planting and all that sort of stuff. And as I say, I've done a lot of different jobs over the years, but they've all been physical. I've never had an easy job.
Work, really, has it?
All work, but it's okay. It's kept me fit.
Yeah.
I still work now. I've been at work all day today.
Yeah.
What are you doing these days?
We're underpinning a concrete slab down at Stanford that's got some heavy oil tanks on the slab, and the guy that built it didn't put proper footings under it, and it's starting to subside. So we've took the job on to... underpin it.
So it's still construction?
Yeah, I've got six guys work for me full time.
Oh, right. Oh, it's your business then?
Yeah, I've got my own. I've been working for myself in construction since 87.
So how many hours a day do you reckon you work?
I do eight, and then sometimes I'll do a bit more.
Yeah.
And then weekends, in the summer, I cut and sell firewood.
Yeah.
That's how I met these couple here.
What about your social life? Are you able to get
social life? I have a lady that I'm involved with. My wife, I lost her in 2015.
Sorry.
She had Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
That started immediately after Caroline died. She started to go down the tubes.
Yeah.
Of course, Hannah was very ill, and she had an embolism nearly killed her. We thought we'd lose them both, and I think the mental stress was too much for her.
Yeah.
She was, when she was diagnosed with it, she was 58.
Goodness.
And 12 years she was ill with it. I looked after her and employed a woman to help me. And we took care of her for 12 years.
Yeah.
And then she went into a nursing home at Malvern.
Yeah.
And she died there in 15.
That was a difficult time then for you.
Well, I've never known anything other than difficult times. I mean, living with the grandmother, they were difficult times.
Yeah.
But I don't regret anything I've ever done.
No.
I'm not sorry that I've had the life I've had. I could...
Good.
Moan and groan and say what a terrible time I've had. But in some ways it made me a stronger person.
Yeah.
And you do have indoor plumbing these days.
You do. Spoiled. Ruined. Yeah. We're lazy now. We're lazy.
Yeah, your knobs don't know how the other half live.
When I was 11, I had to take care of all that.
Mm-hmm.
And we had where we lived at Chelsea then, we had a big garden.
Yeah.
Oh, it would be 30 yards long and 10 yards wide.
Vegetables, fruit?
Yeah. I used to dig it by hand. I was 11.
Yeah.
And I used to spade it. And in the winter, from, we'll say, October through till spring, I would dig so many rows every night. I'd go along, back, maybe four or five, and gradually work my way up the blasted thing.
Yeah.
And then where I dug it, I would put in, you know, early crops or whatever. And, of course, the old bucket under the board, that was a wonderful opportunity because you could whack it up the trench and then dig some soil back on it. And grew wonderful cabbages.
Yeah.
Cabbages as big as buckets. No, it was marvellous fertiliser, I have to say that.
You get involved with the local shows, agricultural shows?
No, I steered clear of most of that.
Yeah.
I was always too busy. I was born and lived with my grandmother at the beginning of my life and we had nothing. Literally, we had nothing.
Yeah.
I used to go out and poach pheasants so we could have something on the table. And I've shot rabbits and stuff, and we vet them. And because we had nothing. And she used to, somehow or other, she used to make meals from nothing. I don't know how she did it.
Yeah.
She was an amazing person. She could conjure something up. If you went and shot a couple of pigeons, she'd make a good meal.
Yeah.
She'd get some vegetables.
They
knew how to do it.
Yeah.
But they'd lived that poverty life.
Yeah.
Like I say, they don't know nothing about poverty now. If they can't afford the latest iPhone, they think they're living in poverty.
Yeah, you might have been brought up in financial poverty, but I don't get the impression that you were poor.
We weren't.
Not from a family and a social point.
No, we. When I talk about poverty, I refer to financial poverty.
Mm.
But people in this day and age, they think that's all that poverty is about. But they've never lived in poverty. There's nobody in this country that I can say has any reason to live in poverty because they're too well looked after. If you go, you can't live in poverty in this country unless you self-inflict it.
Mm.
You have to self-inflict it. I mean, if you're going to take drugs and get drunk every day and then moan because you can't afford the newest iPhone on the market, well, that's your own fault, isn't it? You know, I have no sympathy for people and
you've had to work hard all your
life. Well, I'd have had nothing if I hadn't have done that.
Yeah.
I've worked. Well, Jerry knows
that. Is it a philosophy that's respected by people, do you think? Do you think other people... Have you had respect in your life for the hard work you've done?
I think I've done enough to get some respect.
Good.
I mean, I've been on the local parish council for 33 years.
Good.
I'm chairman of the village hall at Shelsley.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people. I can sit down with the local squires and... you know, I get invited to Rockhill, which is the local Sir Anthony Winnington's resident, local squire.
Good.
I'm not...
You've fitted well into this community, I can
tell. I think that if you do the right things, you do.
Yeah.
I find now that I'm going to more and more funerals of people that I respected.
Yeah.
And which is sad. I mean, I went to one last week and the week before. Both people I highly respected.
Yeah.
Both of them had been wonderful people in the community. And
does it hold any fear for you?
Pardon?
Does it hold any fear for you when you see people that you've
Well,
known?
It does. It saddens me because they're the people that I grew up with,
yeah.
and they were born in the area. And, I mean, Shelsley Parish Council, there's 9 of us on the council, and I'm the only one who was born in the village.
Yeah.
And there's nobody on that parish council that lived in the village when I first joined it.
Yeah.
And so they sit there rabbiting on about things going on in Shelsley, and they know nothing about what happened in Shelsley.
Mm.
I have to tell them sometimes, well, you've got this wrong, because and give them a bit of history lesson.
Yeah.
And have you ever lived anywhere other than Shelsley?
Not lived as dwelling, no. I mean, I've been quite a few places, holidays and stuff, but no, I've never lived anywhere. No, I've always lived. I was born, as I say, at Worcester Royal. I lived at New Mill Bridge, and I only live half a mile from New Mill Bridge now.
Yeah.
Mm. I've never moved out of Shelsley, and I've never wanted to. Because if you live around here, why would you want to live anywhere else?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Cherry and Sue feel the same way. You've got to, you, once you settle in around here. But that's why so many people want to live around here.
Mm.
That's the reason. Mm. They just want to be in this area.
Yeah. Are you fearful for your own mortality, for your own life?
No.
No. You just take the days as you come to them?
Yeah. When you've got to go, you've got to go. There's nothing you can do about it. And I know it's old-fashioned now, but I think the man up there, he decides when you're going to go.
Yeah.
And when he does, you can't arm wrestle him. You've got to go.
You're not going to argue then.
No, but until that day comes, I mean, I've seen a lot of people die that shouldn't have died.
Yeah.
And I've seen a lot of people still alive that ought to have been dead years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think
it's
that
a philosophy to hold on to, isn't it?
And I suggest that's probably the perfect point to go on to your little...
I just want to say thank you very much for...
Once we got through the eternal verities, it's... A
now I'm going to show you some pictures.
Okay. I'm not a religious man.
No.
I believe in God. I do believe that God exists, but my idea maybe of him and other people's ideas it might not be the same. So, I mean, I go to funerals and weddings and I will go to church occasionally, but I don't go every week.
No.
And I think whoever it is we refer to as God, I think everybody's got their own ideas of who he is.
Mm.
There's Buddhists, Muslims, Christians, Jews, Hindus, whatever. And I think it's the same driver with different buzzes.
Yeah.
That's how I look at it. It's the same driver, different buzzes.
Brilliant.
That's how I look at it.
And I would agree with that too. Now I'm going to show you some pictures.
So this is just the last sort of formal section that the project needs to capture some of the dialect words that you might use.
Okay.
So Trish will show you some photographs.
Yeah.
And she's not going to tell you what they are.
No.
Other than the photographs. We just want to record what you would call the thing you see or the activity you see in the picture.
Yeah.
Do you want a light on this?
So what can you see on there?
It's a hedgehog.
Yeah.
The Roman is called urchins. Yeah.
What, hedgehogs?
Yeah, they call them urchins.
What was that?
We call them daddy long legs, but I mean, what fly they are. Forget what they call them now.
It's crane fly.
Crane fly they are, yeah, crane fly. We call them daddy long legs. That's an earwig. Oh, I can't see that.
Right.
It's goose grass. It's a dewdrop.
What?
Dewdrop.
Oh, dewdrop.
Want some bag of sweets?
Yeah.
It's some kind of bread, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. What sort?
Well, we'd call that a bun or a bap.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose that's cream and that's tea cakes, is it?
Mm-hmm. Do you make scones?
Yeah, scones, tea cakes we call them.
Is that scone or scone?
But it's, scones, we call them. Well, I call them scones. Some folks call them scones. Spring onions. Piggyback. Seesaw.
This is.
Hmm?
Right. He asked me to fix it and I said.
Yeah, it's sort Which? Of fill in the blanks with the term that you might use.
Oh, he asked me to fix his. He asked me to fix it, and I said,
"No way."
Do it yourself. Yeah.
The food was.
Well, I'd just say the food was very tasty, or quite tasty.
And that's it, I think. Thank you. Yeah.
Is that all right?
Yeah.
Well, okay, brilliant. Yeah.
You know, that's one of the best hours I've spent for a long time. That was absolutely brilliant. As a piece of oral history, it defies.
I'm still recording.
In the
I should shut up.
In the Black Country, they call that. Boston fiddle.
Oh, what?
Do you know Black Country much?
Oh, yeah.
Boston fiddle, are you?
I know. Well, Boston. Oh, my family comes from that.
No, that
John,
was Black Country.
Yeah, but
thanks. I'd just like to say, as we before I close this down, thank you very, very much for your time.
That's all right.
And thanks so much for your stories.
Yeah, that's all right.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, drag that off.
To listen to you talking and learn about your life and everything
is this,
else.
Is this what you're doing?
Let go of me.
Is this a,
Let go of me.
Are there lots of other people just getting together and...